A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging arts organizations and institutions. Today, we'll hear from the Princeton Girl Choir, which just announced plans to preserve at least part of the American Boy Choir legacy by forming its own Boy Choir division. I'll speak with Executive Director Hillary Butler and Artistic Director Linnell Joy Jenkins, as well as Paul Meads, the Boy Choir's former Director of Vocal Studies, who will head up the new program. We'll also get an update on how Houston's performing arts organizations are holding up after Hurricane Harvey. The news this week across the U.S. has been dominated by Hurricane Harvey, and the arts community of Houston will be facing all of the same challenges that lie ahead. The city's downtown theater district, the second largest in the U.S. in terms of the number of theater seats, was inundated, and among the district's residents are the Alley Theater, the Houston Symphony Orchestra, the Houston Ballet, and Houston Grand Opera. As the waters have begun to recede, these organizations are just starting to take stock of the damage. The symphony has canceled its opening gala scheduled for September 9th and two other performances, but plans to start its 2017-2018 season on September 14th. Houston Grand Opera still plans to begin its season October 20th, but said in a statement that it suffered damage to its costume shop and wig shop and will face other challenges in bringing its education programs to schools and community centers. Next week, the opera plans to entertain children in shelters with its storybook opera program. Houston Ballet still hopes to open its season as expected on September 21st. Molly Glenzer is the Houston Chronicle's arts critic, and she took some time out to speak with me about Harvey's impact on the 17-block theater district, a major anchor and source of cultural tourism for the city.
At the heart of the district are three major performance venues of varying ages. The oldest is Jones Hall, where the symphony performs, and that's also where touring productions from the Society for the Performing Arts are staged. That building was built in the 1960s. Across the street, sort of catacorner to that, is the Alley Theater, which was built 49 years ago. That is the home of the Alley Theater, obviously, Houston's resident theater company. In the adjacent block is the Wortham Theater Center, which opened in 1987, and that is the home of Houston Ballet and Houston Grand Opera.
And so what type of damage are we looking at?
The Alley Theater suffered by far the worst damage because water inundated its basement level, and that includes the New House stage, which is the theater's intimate performance space. It has about 300 seats, as well as the theater's basement areas. And the water was, you know, literally lapping the ceiling of that theater. Beyond that, I think the biggest issue has been the central parking garage that serves the theater district, as well as Jones Hall and the Wortham Theater are all owned by the City of Houston and managed by an organization called Houston First. There's a system of about 15 different floodgates that were activated on Friday before the storm came in, because flooding has been an issue down there before. But in spite of that, the garage, which goes down three levels, so it's about 30 feet deep, completely filled with water. So that's a major pumping job. You can't even begin to pump out the water until it has somewhere to go. And one of the issues is that the theater district is really perched right on the banks of Buffalo Bayou, which is the central waterway of many waterways that cross Houston. But it's really the biggest, and it's been prone to flooding and ruining, you know, downtown, you know, since the early 1900s.
There are just so many aspects of this. There's the physical damage, plus obviously we're getting notices of the initial cancellations now as these groups are looking ahead. What are some of the most immediate impacts that these organizations are facing at this point?
For the Alley Theater, it meant, of course, an immediate end to the show they had running. They were performing Alfred Hitchcock's 39 Steps. They just announced yesterday that they will open their first two productions of the season at the University of Houston. So they found alternative space for their first two productions, but that's, you know, that's a huge logistics problem, you know, involving tickets and everything else. Houston Ballet was due to open on September 8th, next Friday. They had a program, a triple bill that was to have opened, and that show has been canceled for now, likely to be rescheduled at some point later, but the ballet doesn't have an answer yet about when and where they might be able to do that program. It would have gone for six performances, and now they hope to open their season still on the 21st of September with their company premiere of Sir Kenneth Macmillan's Meyerling. We had just published our arts guide for the coming season on August 20th. It's 48 pages of listings for shows, you know, from all levels of the arts community, the symphony, the opera, the ballet, the theater, literary readings, and virtually everything that was due to open next week has been postponed or canceled. The major organizations that use the halls of the theater district are really a little bit in limbo until Houston First can determine the extent of damages and begin repairs. All of those organizations have been told they cannot even enter their facilities until Tuesday.
As you mentioned, that area is prone to flooding, and back in 2001, the area did face some severe problems, certainly not nearly what they're seeing now, but with Allison. Were there some things that organizations had done after Allison that perhaps helped mitigate even the horrendous issues we're seeing now?
Yes. Actually, some of the floodgates, as I understand it, in the garage that leads to basement walkways into the Alley Theater in Jones Hall were installed after Allison. And as far as we know, I think they won't know until they get the garage completely emptied, but they believe those floodgates did work. So the damage during Allison at Jones Hall was really catastrophic. At that point, the Houston Symphony had its music library in the basement, and it also had, you know, priceless instruments stored there. And the Society for the Performing Arts had its offices there. All of that was completely inundated in Tropical Storm Allison. So steps were taken after Allison to install floodgates closer to the tunnels to those areas. And that area did not flood nearly as badly this time. And of course, the symphony had long since moved its most precious areas up to higher ground.
That was Molly Glenser, arts critic for the Houston Chronicle. Artists have indeed begun jumping in to provide support in their own way. Violinist Rebecca Reel was among a number of Houston Symphony Orchestra members bringing music and a few moments of peace and comfort to those in city shelters.
It's been kind of difficult to get in touch with some of the shelters, but we have managed to set up a relationship with the George R. Brown Convention Center. We started on Thursday. We played on Thursday, Friday. We have two groups going today and probably tomorrow. And then we've also gone to the Family Residence Salvation Army and the Men's Shelter. And those are just three of them that we've been able to go to as of now, but we're hoping to play it many more in the future.
What type of program are you bringing them?
We're bringing mostly classical music. But then, of course, when we have some requests from people that are listening, we played Happy Birthday for a girl who had her birthday yesterday. And if we can play it and they request it, we'll do it.
What are the responses and reactions that you're getting?
Wow. Some of the responses are amazing. I mean, a lot of the evacuees are I'm just honored to be able to bring music to them at this time. And they're really expressing their gratitude. I mean, there's only so much that the shelters can provide for them in terms of entertainment. And they've thanked us for kind of bringing some new light in and switching things up a little bit, which has been really nice.
And what size ensembles have you been sending? What collection of performers?
Anywhere from trios to quintets. So like we had a brass quintet play at George R. Brown yesterday, and I played in a string trio yesterday at the family residence, and we have a string quartet tomorrow that's going to try to play at NRG. So mostly ranging from like 3 to 5 musicians.
Well, I can imagine there's just so much you could be occupying your time with, whether it's your own recovery or helping friends and just other ways to volunteer. What made you feel that this was the best way for you to respond in the aftermath of Harvey?
I tried volunteering at some shelters, but they weren't accepting any more volunteers. And I've heard that's the case for a lot of places. So I wanted to find a way to help without interfering. And I felt a strong urge to do something impactful. So since the symphony can't directly help Houston physically rebuild, I wanted to find a way to help Houstonians emotionally rebuild. And I think bringing music into the shelters is probably the best way to do that at this point.
What does it look like for the next week or so? You said you have a few more performances?
As of now, we don't have any rehearsals at Jones until the 14th of September. So I've gotten enough responses from musicians in the symphony to probably play at a shelter every single day until then, if not multiple shelters. So it's been overwhelming, honestly, to have like so many musicians get back eager to play and get out there.
That was Rebecca Reel, a violinist with the Houston Symphony Orchestra. The recovery ahead will be a long process, as the Nashville Symphony learned back in 2010 when its performance home, Skirmerhorn Symphony Center, faced more than $40 million in damage following severe flooding. Alan Valentine is the symphony's president and CEO, and he said draining the water was only the beginning.
We had cracked slabs at the foundation that had to be, you know, jackhammered out and replaced. The water was contaminated with all kinds of things, so it was really kind of a hazmat condition in our basement. But we were fortunate the water didn't make it into the concert hall, but we had to seal off the concert hall and create essentially negative energy in the building. So we were sucking air from the levels above the basement into the basement and out the back of the building, you know. And so as the water receded, we created that kind of negative energy in the rest of the building so that mold spores would find their way into the rest of the building and begin to do even more damage to the upper floors of the building. So there are a lot of issues. I mean, from mold to, you know, structural concerns. You know, we had to check the structural integrity of the building. We had, of course, in the case of our electrical vault, all of the big cables that come into the electrical vault where the switch gear is that provides the power distribution to the building, all of those cables had gotten water down into the insulation. And when you have water in a copper wire like that, you run the risk that it's going to corrode the wire. And if the wire gets corroded and becomes less conductive of electricity, it could become a giant resistor, essentially, that heats up like an iron when you plug an iron in. That's what an iron is. And if that were to happen, you know, then you have fire risk in the future, you know. So all of that stuff had to be sorted out. We had to replace, of course, a lot of wiring. We also were lucky that we were able to treat some of those larger cables and basically vacuum the water out and then treat them with anti-corrosive material that was forced down into the cable insulation. So there's a lot of things to think about, and water does a lot more damage than you think.
That was Alan Valentine, president and CEO of the Nashville Symphony. You can hear more of my conversations with today's guests in the Arts and Cultural News section of our website at wwfm.org. You can also find information on how to help at these organizations' websites, HoustonSymphony.org, HoustonGrandOpera.org, HoustonBallet.org, or AlleyTheater.org. The American Federation of Musicians has a Harvey Relief Fund to support musicians impacted by the storm, which can be found at afm.org/2017/09/Harvey-Relief-Fund. For a more general list of organizations helping out in the wake of Harvey, the Houston Chronicle has compiled a list at its website at chron.com. The legal formalities in winding down the American Boy Choir have just begun, but one local organization is looking to move ahead in ensuring that at least some of that legacy continues in the region. The Princeton Girl Choir announced this week that it will launch its own boy choir division, with auditions starting later this month. Fred Meade, who is director of vocal studies at the Boy Choir, has been tapped to head up the new program. I sat down this week to talk with Meade, as well as Princeton Girl Choir Executive Director Hillary Butler and Artistic Director Linnell Joy Jenkins about their plans. Butler said it made sense to step in and pick up the program as a way to expand musical opportunities for children in the area.
This is something that, as Princeton Girl Choir, we've thought about as a potential piece of the pie for a while. We've been friends and colleagues with the American Boy Choir in many ways for many years. We've collaborated with them over the years. We have a lot of staff that's worked for both organizations, and so there's always been a natural fit between our two groups. And so when the Boy Choir ended up closing, we really felt like, first off, from a staffing perspective, we have these wonderful people who are now available to keep doing more in our community, and we didn't want to lose that. And also, we wanted to make sure that we were providing a rich and vibrant place for the boys in this area to sing and to continue that high level of performance and music education that they've been blessed with singing at the American Boy Choir School. And our hope is that with this being an after-school program, that we may hopefully be able to connect more boys in our community with song, bring them into singing, get them actively engaged in this way, and help to build them in the way that the Boy Choir has done for so many years for the boys that have sung there.
And Fred?
Exactly. I'm thrilled that this is going to happen. I didn't expect a boy choir to be formed so quickly, but when the girl choir approached me, I thought it was the right answer at the right time. And just as Hillary said, I think it provides a great opportunity for American Boy Choir boys, alums that live in the area, and other community boys who want to sing. This is now the choir to come to in Princeton.
And Linnell?
It's really exciting that our Princeton Girl Choir can offer this opportunity for boys to sing and to have this opportunity. And it just was a unique opportunity. And I'm so glad that we were able to take hold of this opportunity so that we could offer a great choral program for boys in the Princeton area.
I know it's very early in the planning stages, but how do you envision this in terms of instruction and in terms of concerts?
So we are obviously very early in the planning stages of this new initiative, because we've really just tried to get it off the ground as soon as we heard that the Boy Choir was closing. So we are officially
two weeks in
to our planning stages. And so we're starting to get an idea of what the rehearsal process and the performance schedule will look like for the boys that are singing in this program. Currently, we're looking at most likely starting two groups, one that is for unchanged voices of kind of an intermediate level, and the second that is of an advanced level for both changed and unchanged voices, so that they'll be able to sing SATB music and also be able to potentially sing TTB music, depending upon what the voicing looks like of the boys at any given time during the season. As a result, we can see a lot of potential for some really interesting performances as well throughout our area, as well as potentially looking at what can be done in broader afield. Our girls, for instance, will go on performance tours every summer. So that's something that we're looking at and considering for the boys as well. Is that something that we want to build into their schedule and performance structure? So I think over the next couple of weeks, we'll have a much more solid idea of what that looks like. But that's the approach that we're currently taking as we put those plans in place.
I think it also opens the possibility of performances between with the girls and boys together, combining the levels of choirs and the parts, and provides a lot of opportunities as well.
That kind of gets to a discussion we had before we started the actual interview, and that's the differences between what people hear and experience from a boy choir versus a girl choir versus a children's choir. I know, Linnell, you had said that there are many different ways to look at that, but From a vocal and audience experience perspective, how are these traditions different?
You know, I think as an audience member myself, when I hear a boy choir, I'm just always amazed that these young men are able to produce such beauty of sound. And the beauty of sound reminds me very much of the more of the English boy choir tradition and hearing that sound. And a lot of our boy choirs in here and nationwide have fostered their sound after that English boy choir type of sound. But they also, as we have developed in the American choral traditions, we sing a variety of different literature, different than what would happen probably in an Anglican, type of a situation where a boy choir would be needed for church service music. But they have an opportunity to sing a variety of different literature, so their vocal tone will adapt to the style that is needed. So you still hear that boy choir sound on those choral traditions that come to us from the church music tradition of, but you also hear a variety of different color in the voice depending upon the style of music. And I think for girl choir and children's choirs as well in this our American choral traditions, we get to sing a variety of different literature from early music all the way over to South African pieces. So they adapt the sound to the style of music.
Exactly. And it's interesting. I've been thinking just like when the last time I heard a boy choir concert, when's the last time I heard a girl choir concert? Well, I work with both age levels. Mostly in my position at the boy choir school, I work with the same kind of age level as in the Princeton Girl Choir. And the training that I provided was pretty identical. But working with boys was sometimes a little more different than working with girls. It was just a looseness maybe working with the boys and making sure the boys were inspired. I don't know how to say this. Just they can be more rambunctious, perhaps that's the word, sometimes. So you adapt your teaching style. But in terms of the vocal training itself, it was basically the same that I've been doing with both groups. But once you interpret the repertoire, sometimes the color of the sound changes. And obviously, at the American Boy Choir School, working through the transition of the changing voice was part of the training of the boys. They were brought right through the program. Nobody was eliminated, as in would be in the English tradition. So bringing those boys into the boy choir program at the Princeton Girl Choir will do the same thing. We'll adapt them to the program, adjust the repertoire, adjust the training, so all boys are able to sing.
Looking at the training side of it, the American Boy Choir School was a complete school experience, and I'm not sure exactly how that broke down between your regular subjects and music, but now as you switch to an after-school program, what are some ways you're looking at bringing that depth of training to a program that may have fewer hours available to really work that through?
We're looking to expand our music educational offerings. We currently have voice classes and musicianship training classes, the oral training, and the sight singing. So we're looking to expand those under the direction of Fred to be able to assist both the Princeton Girl Choir and then our choral program for the boys.
That's also something that as we continue expanding those music education offerings, we're hoping to be able to bring in some of the broader community for those as well. We've had a lot of people who've asked, is there some, stronger music theory classes for kids who really want to dig into those? We get a lot of inquiries for kids who are in that kindergarten through second grade age that haven't yet aged into the girl choir or our new boy choir division. They want to sing. They love to sing. They want to develop those skills. So we're looking at ways that we can create programs that will bring them in as well. So as we're looking at this new structure, we're really trying to look at it in a very holistic fashion of, yes, how do we continue supporting what the girls do and increase and improve their experience? How do we do the very best that we can under limited hours, as you mentioned, to help the boys that are coming in to continue to have a robust and full experience that trains the full musician? But then also, how can we best translate that experience to as much of the community as possible so that it's not just these elite kids who have auditioned and been selected and placed in these programs, but also any kid in the area who wants to sing and wants the experience and wants to perhaps at one point be ready to be in one of these elite groups.
As I think one of you mentioned earlier, that now basically the boy choir experience is opened up to a broader range of people. But do you also expect, as far as the reach, considering that the boy choir used to draw from across the country virtually, any thoughts on how far your geographic reach might be able to spread for students who are interested in joining?
It's always difficult to know until boys start showing interest as to what that's going to look like. But I can say on the girl choir side of things, we regularly have girls who are traveling an hour or more each week in each direction to come to rehearsals. We've had kids who've come from the southern tip of New Jersey or the Poconos down to be part of the girl choir experience. So I think that it really becomes a question of what kind of a program we're building and what kind of a draw that has for the boys that are in our region. We are thrilled to have anybody who wants to come and audition be a part of what we do. It's really a question of how that logistically fits for their family.
Just remind us a little bit about the history of the girl choir and the age range you're looking for and what age range you'll be accepting boys.
My predecessor, Jan Westrick, actually attended a national choral conference that was produced and hosted by the American Boy Choir School some time ago. And it was a yearly event that happened usually in the fall, usually about September or October. And she just kept thinking to herself, man, there really should be a program for girls, something that is comparable to what the American Boy Choir was doing, but that was an after-school program. So in 1989, she started out with a handful of girls, to begin the Princeton Girl Choir. So it started in 1989, probably about a couple handful of girls, but it has now grown to almost 300 girls in the program. And now we're to seven choirs, which started with one choir at that time. We've now have grown to seven choirs. So she saw the need. And so how wonderful that we also see the need for a choral program for boys at this time. With now the American Boy Choir closing, we've saw the opportunity to provide a program for boys. So we're so excited that we were able to fulfill two needs, one in 1989 and one in 2017.
We are looking for boys who are from 4th through 12th grade to come into the program. We would anticipate that some of those boys who are in the younger age groups would probably be a better fit for the intermediate level choir that we're planning to begin. And then the kind of older middle school and high school boys would probably be a better fit for the advanced mixed voice group.
That was Hillary Butler, executive director of the Princeton Girl Choir. She was joined by artistic director Linnell Joy Jenkins and Paul Meads, the former head of vocal studies at the American Boy Choir, who will be heading up the new program. The Girl Choir's website can be found at princetongirlchoir.org. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you each week on A Tempo. But remember, programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for being a member of the global listening community that is the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.